Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of Eat Your Words, broadcasting live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Talia Ralph, bringing you all the best in words about food, maybe even some food about words. Today, we are taking a trip to Texas via a tiny New York kitchen, specifically the New York kitchen of Lisa Fain. Lisa has been blogging since 2005 to assuage her cravings for her hometown cuisine. She's a seventh-generation Texan and food blogger, and while she may have left the wide expanses of the Lone Star State for the close quarters of the Big Apple, she brings her family history and recipes to the table on her blog, The Homesick Texan, and in her second cookbook, The Homesick Texan's Family Table. The book, a follow-up to her first guide to all things deliciously Texan, showcases over 100 recipes curated from Lisa's own family, friends, and of course her kitchen. Everything from Mexican-inspired German chocolate cake to chicken and dumplings. So Lisa, thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm wondering, because this book is, you know, the family table, what it was like growing up in Texas. You said you grew up in Houston. Sort of what got you into food, and what are some of your biggest food memories from that early time?
Well, I come from a family of cooks. On both sides of my family, everyone loves to cook. And so for me, it was growing up, just there was always homemade food. My grandparents actually grew up on farms. And when I was young, both of their parents' farms were actually still working farms. So we would go up on the weekends and pick crops and things like that. So I always had a really close relationship with food in Texas. And so it was good homemade food. We would go out to eat a couple of times a week. We'd go get Mexican food or barbecue or a phenomenon which is big in Texas called the cafeteria, which isn't like a school cafeteria, but it is like a cafeteria where, you know, it's just like a bunch of comfort food and you actually go down a line with your tray. And that was very popular when I was young. And, you know, it's just these memories, you know, that I don't have anything that's like specific, but I do have lots of fond memories of, you know, like sitting on my great grandma's porch, shelling peas, you know, baking chocolate pie with my grandma, you know, watching my dad make chicken fried steak or my mom make tortillas or cream gravy and just all these things, you know, I didn't find them unique until I came to New York.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Yeah. And people always sort of ask if you're in food, you know, like what got you into food? Where are you, you know, Where does it come from? Do you have a moment in your head where you remember being like, oh my God, this is it?
You know, I guess it might have been probably my senior year in college. My friends and I, we actually had a house. So it was like the first time we had a kitchen, and it was the sort of thing we like went off the meal plan and we were fending for ourselves. And that's kind of when I really, you know, we really started getting experimental. And of course, we didn't have any money. So it was like 101 things to do with ramen noodles, you know, and things like that. But, you know, I got my first cookbook then. It was Sheila Lukin's. It wasn't the Silver Palette. It's the second one, the New Basics Cookbook. And mm-hmm. When I was a senior in college, we just kind of like cooked our way through that. And that was kind of, for me, it was some different foods, but it was kind of, I was like, oh, I really like this. So.
Right. I mean, it sounds like, I mean, I have a friend that grew up in Texas and visited recently, and from what you write in the book and sort of my own northeastern, you know, fantasies of Texas, it sounds like a pretty idyllic place to grow up, both food-wise, I mean, especially food-wise. And so I'm wondering what, when and why you made the move to New York.
Oh, that's a good question. Well, you know, it's kind of like one of those things where you don't appreciate what you have until you don't have it anymore. And despite this great childhood I had, and I loved Texas, but I always wanted to be a little, I wanted what I thought would be a more exciting life, I guess, instead of, you know, going to my grandparents' farm in the summer and driving the tractor around, I wanted to go see Broadway plays. So I always loved New York, and I actually visited for the first time when I was 10. And it just kind of, and it was that and like the book from the Mixed Up Files and Miss Bazley Frankweiler and Sesame Street and all these things like made me think that New York was probably the coolest place on the planet. And so when I turned 25, I had the opportunity to move here, and I took it.
Yeah, New York does. New York is one of those cities like Paris or London that gets great marketing just from like our books and movies and growing up. Totally, I felt the same way.
Yeah.
So would you say now you've been here 19 years?
Yeah, I moved here in 1995.
Wow. And just pick up and move, or were you coming for a job? Or?
I did. I had a job. I was living in Austin before I moved here, and I was working in a children's bookstore that's no more, sadly, in Austin, and I got a job working in a children's bookstore in New York. And so I just... I was 25, and a bunch of my friends from Texas, we all kind of moved up here at the same time. You know, we're young and careful. You know, when you're 25, you can do whatever you want. So, so I moved up here with a big group of Texans, and we just had a blast.
Cool. So, are you all still here?
No. Sadly, I'm the only one left.
Wow.
They all, I think 9/11 was kind of like, a lot of them after 9/11 were like, I'm done.
Interesting.
Yeah, so they all went back. Well, one went to... Nashville, but the rest are back in Texas. Mm-hmm. So
why do you think that was?
Well, 9/11, I really don't want to talk about 9/11, but it was a pretty devastating day, you know, and I think for a lot of people, it was sort of this moment where you just started reevaluating your life. And, you know, I mean, I do now have a family that lives here. My cousins live here, Tex and Andrew, but, then none of us really had family here. We didn't have any roots. And I think 9/11 was the sort of thing where you kind of just wanted to get back to your roots. I didn't go myself. I had a really good job, and it was, you know, I had a lot of friends here, and I thought about it, but I kind of felt I'm going to stick it out and see what happens.
For sure. And you're still here, right?
I'm still here.
Although I just had a really interesting conversation with a friend's stepdad that stuck with me, where he said, you know, eventually most people will move either back where their family is or sort of in closer proximity because, you know, he was just saying as you get older and the stuff starts to matter more and, yeah, maybe tragedies, personal tragedies or national tragedy, whatever they are, you know, life makes you rethink that. Do you think about that? Do you think you'll head back one day?
I do. You know, I do. I mean, like I said, I have close friends here, and now I do have family. But I actually, for the past, like, 5 years, I have been spending a lot more time in Texas. I end up spending probably over the course of a year, almost like 2 months in Texas. So my goal is, I mean, I do love New York, but I do love Texas, obviously. So my goal is at some point to try to find some sort of balance, like maybe do half and half. For me, the biggest challenge is where to go in Texas. You know, I have dear friends in Austin, my mom's in Houston, my grandma and a lot of my family's in the Dallas area, you know, and then I just love like West Texas, like Alpine and Marfa. So for me, the biggest decision is if I do like get a place in Texas, where would I put down roots?
Right. And I think that's so really interesting about Texas and a lot of places in the States where you talk about Texas and you don't just have Texan cuisine because it's so big and so diverse and there's so much going on there culinarily and just geographically. It's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, what for you, and you do sort of outline some of them in the book, but what are the various cuisines of Texas, you know?
Well, you know, you, because like you say, it's very regional, you know, and it is a border state to Mexico. So, you know, Tex-Mex, Mexican inspired, you know, cuisine is very huge. And it's not just along the border. I mean, it's all over the state. And actually, you know, Tex-Mex sometimes gets a bad rap, but I mean, it can be, when it's well done, it can be just as delicious as any, you know, other cuisine. I mean, it's my favorite, hands down. But then, you know, you have barbecue, and Texas barbecue is beef based. Primarily, and not as saucy as, you know, some people do like sauce, but primarily it's just like smoked beef and smoked pork ribs. You have the Southern influence. So like in East Texas, especially, you know, you have just kind of like sort of typical deep South dishes, you know, like, you know, fried catfish and lots of vegetables and, you know, chicken fried steak and fried chicken and things like that. And then also there's like smothered pork chops and, you know, it's not all fried food. And then of course you have, you know, it's a border state with the Gulf of Mexico. So, you know, there's a huge seafood influence. And it's interesting because you see as you go down the coast, like when you're more up I don't know, northeastern, like closer to the Louisiana border. You know, it's more, you know, sort of a Cajun-inspired seafood. But as you go down, like down to Padre Island, you know, you start to see more of a Mexican influence with the seafood. So that's really interesting, actually. You know, that more needs to be written about the seafood of Texas, I think. And then now, you know, you see there's a lot of, especially in Houston, you know, there's a large new population moving in. There's a large Vietnamese population arriving. And they've been, you know, staying, they've been moving there for, you know, over like 20 years. But, you know, you do see this Vietnamese cuisine is very popular in Houston, and that's starting to actually spread throughout the state. Likewise, in Houston, there's a large Indian population. So, you know, Indian cuisine is very popular there. So it's always evolving, which is what's really exciting about Texas food for me.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And do you think that people sort of see that diversity, or do you find, like, being in New York or when you're traveling around, people sort of lump Texas food into one thing, like, oh, Tex-Mex or, oh, you know, ribs?
Yeah. I think most people who haven't been to Texas, or if they've only been to Austin for South by Southwest, they kind of have a very, you know, I wouldn't say narrow. Well, maybe narrow is the right word, but I mean, it's a very limited view of what Texan cuisine is. I mean, Texan, and like I said, there's nothing wrong with barbecue and Tex-Mex and chicken fried steak. I mean, these are my, you know, three favorite things, but it has evolved beyond that. And I think sometimes you almost get a sense I don't know if you saw, there was an article in the New York Times that I talked about where I'd eaten when I was on book tour a couple of weeks ago. And, I talked about getting puffy tacos, which is an iconic San Antonio dish. Mm-hmm. And people from San Antonio were like, but we have Thai food now. We have, you know, all these. And I'm like, I know, but, you know, this mm-hmm. is what they want to see.
Right. And I mean, do you think you go back to Texas often? Do you think that there's still like this strong regional influence, or is it sort of getting either diluted or exported, or, you know, sort of people being too narrow about, like, I'm just going to go to Texas and I, you know, I'm going to be in Austin, I'm going to go to Franklin Barbecue and that's it. Narrow in our thinking about Southern food?
That's a good question. I think most of the people I talk to in New York, they either go to Austin or Houston, maybe Dallas. And I think there is some exploration, you know, when they go to like Austin, like they'll eat at Uchi or Paul Key's new place, you know. I can't remember the name, but there's a ramen place that everyone raves about. So I think there is, you know, a sense of exploration of the new Texan cuisine for sure.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so sort of on the flip side, now that you live in New York and when you go back to Texas, what do the Texans think about New York or New York food? Do you see that similar sort of like, what do you eat there? Pizza and bagels? Like, is there a reversal of the narrowing? Because I think so often you know, the further away you are from something, the simpler the sketch is in your mind. Do you get that a lot?
No, that's a great way to describe it. Oh, yeah. People think, pizza, bagels. I can't remember what. It was something in Queens. It was something unusual, like Indonesian or something like that. And I said, we went, and I was telling a friend, oh, yeah, we had Indonesian cuisine. And they're like, what? In New York? And I was like, well, of course. I mean, it's like Los Angeles or Houston, especially. I mean, it's just, there's so much here. You know, I mean, I probably haven't had a bagel in 3 weeks.
Right. Yeah. I think there is like obviously drastic differences, but also a similarity in terms mm-hmm. of just how many different cuisines are available in such a small space. Like, I was in Austin, which is pretty cosmopolitan. It's not, you know, I don't know if you would call it deep Texas or the heart of Texas, but there was just, you walk for 10-15 minutes and you see just a real diversity of different foods. So have you sort of become, do you feel like you're like the ambassador for New York when you're in Texas and vice versa here? I mean,
I do feel when I'm here, definitely I mean, that's what I've been doing for the past 9 years that I've done the blog. I mean, and even before I started the blog, I mean, I've always felt like an ambassador for Texan cuisine. I mean, unofficial, of course, but I mean, no, it's my favorite food. I mean, and for me, I mean, the reason why I started, I mean, back in 1995, I mean, now in New York, things are much, much improved. But back then, I mean, you couldn't find anything. You couldn't find ingredients. You know, very few restaurants sold Texas food. And if they did, it was terrible. And so it was the sort of thing where I had to take things in my own hand and cook it. And so I'd invite my New York friends over. and say, this is what Texan food really is, you know? And so that's kind of where the whole thing evolved. So, I mean, the whole 19 years I've been here, I've been trying to tell people how wonderful Texas food is.
Right. And what did you, like, what do you think inspired the shift towards going from you not being able to find? I mean, what's an example of something you couldn't find? And when did you sort of see it shift in New York?
I think the shift happened with the rise of South By. I mean, so many people go to that now, you know, and I think they go to Texas and they eat Texas food and they're like, man, this is really good. And I think that sort of, and also the music festivals in Austin. I mean, most of the people, like I said, most of the people I talk to just go to Austin, mm-hmm. you know, and I think they should explore the whole state. But Austin seems to be kind of like the nexus of it. But they come back, you know, to New York and they're like, I want a breakfast taco, or I want that great barbecue brisket like I had. And so I think it's just kind of this, you know, I don't know if there was like one particular person, but it's just a bunch of people that had been going and they just all kind of decided, hey, let's do it.
Yes, and breakfast tacos. There are. I just saw they're serving them somewhere at Gotham West Market.
Oh, really?
My friends and I.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw that.
To go. I mean, I don't know if it'll be the same, but
yeah,
it's true. There are certain foods that you just get like a itch for.
Absolutely.
If you will. Yeah. So you make a lot of stuff from scratch. Mm-hmm. Can you? Was that just born of necessity, or are you still? You still do that now, even though, you know, like you grind your own chili powder. That's not something you have to do. Can you talk a little bit about why you do that and what you think you get out of it, both personally and what the food gets from starting right from the ground floor and making a lot of those ingredients yourself?
Sure. Well, it did start out of necessity. When I was growing up in Texas, you know, chili, we made our chili with chili powder, which you could find, you know, millions of varieties of in Texas, and it was, you know, made in Texas. Flour tortillas, you could find flour, you know, fresh from the, you know, the tortilla maker, warm, fresh flour and corn tortillas in Texas. All these basic, you know, things in your larder, you know, you could not find in New York. Mm-hmm. You know, like I couldn't find good chili powder. I couldn't find good flour tortillas or corn tortillas. And so a lot of it, I mean, it was totally out of necessity. You know, there were a lot of Mexican markets, like in Queens, and there was actually one in my neighborhood. I was up by Columbia when I first moved here. And so I could find whole chili pods. Mm-hmm. And so it was just I had to go back to the basics and start from scratch. And, you know, I taught myself how to make flour tortillas with a Diana Kennedy book and much trial and error. Mm-hmm. My mom actually sent me her tortilla press, which was really great. And so I had, you know, the tools but as I was doing these things from scratch that, you know, normally I wouldn't or even like, you know, I would have, you know, just had like a convenient product when I lived in Texas. Salsa mm-hmm. is another example. I found that they tasted better when you started from scratch, and you had to put a little bit more effort into it, but I just felt the flavor profile was so much superior, and it was fun. I mean, I love to cook, so it wasn't for me trouble or burdensome. It was joyful. So, and I still do it that way.
Right. And if you do ever have to reach for like I really don't feel like making tortillas or this salsa, are there any companies or products that you're like, you know what, they're doing it well enough that I will grab this if I need to, or is it still like,
you know, that's a good question. I haven't bought tortillas or salsa in New York in years. So I have to say though, I was really excited when Whole Foods opened here. I think they opened in 2001, maybe, or 2000, anyway. But, you know, because it's a Texas-based grocery store chain. And then I knew that if I wanted, like, if, you know, their house sauces or flour tortillas probably had some Texan DNA in it. And mm-hmm. so if I needed to, you know, get something that was available.
For sure, yeah. I always forget that Whole Foods started in Austin.
Yeah, no, and yeah, it's, yep. I mean, I've been shopping there my whole life.
Right, it's like your local grocery store. Well, we're actually just going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're talking to the homesick Texan herself, Lisa Fain, here on Eat Your Words. I'm your host, Talia Ralph. This is Heritage Radio Network.
Thank you. right on the edge of the echoes that itch. Your man went back into town.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to Eat Your Words. I'm your host, Talia Ralph. We're here with Lisa Fain, blogger and cookbook author of The Homesick Texan, bringing Texas recipes to New York City and now across the country and the world. Thanks for being with us, Lisa.
Thank you.
So you started blogging about your forays into Texan food here in New York City in 2005. What made you make the leap from just like, hey, I really miss this and I'm making this for myself and my friends, to, hey, I want to put this online, have a bigger audience? How did that start?
Blogging, I guess, kind of, I had a good friend who was doing blogging, not food blogging. I guess he probably started around 2003. And, you know, you started seeing more and more blogs, you know, about whatever, anything. And then around 2005, late 2004, early 2005, I discovered food blogs. And there was only a handful of them. But it was the sort of thing, you know, I love to take photos, I love to cook, and I like to write. And so I thought, hey, this looks like it would be fun. I mean, it was totally a hobby. I was a managing editor at a magazine at the time. And, you know, and back then, which is interesting, I mean, now blogs, not most people, but a lot of people start them with the mindset of, I'm going to make money from this. They start it from a business point of view. But back then, it was purely a hobbyist sort of thing. And for me, it was just, cooking was already my hobby. Photography was already a hobby, and so was writing. So for me, it was just a great way to combine all three passions into one and let my grandma and my mom in Texas know what I was up to. You know, if you had said in 2006 that I would have written two books and I'd be talking to you on a radio show, I would never have thought that would happen.
Yeah, well, 2005, I guess, was like the boom or the beginning of the internet. Was a little bit earlier, but I feel like people started massing around this idea of blogs, so you kind of got in early. What was the learning curve like? I mean, was it...
There was none. I mean, the software, I think, is pretty simple, and I already knew how to take photos, it maybe was like a 10-minute thing, but I mean, that's the wonderful thing about blogging is that, you know, these tools are so simple. And they're available to anyone. I mean, my grandpa's no longer here, but before he died, he had a blog. I mean, this 89-year-old man writing about World War II on the internet. Wow. I think anybody can do it, which is really cool.
For sure, yeah. I mean, I've tried, and I have many, you know, blogs in my blog graveyard, as I'm sure many writers and, you know, food people or hobbyists in general, like you're saying, do. What advice do you have for people looking to start them, aside from like keep it up, or how did you sort of inspire yourself to regularly post? Because I think that's the toughest challenge.
Yeah.
Like, you don't really know who's out there at the beginning, and you don't really know who's waiting to read it. How do you sort of keep yourself going, and what advice would you give to people who are wanting to blog about?
I think the most important thing when you have a blog is to get joy from it and hopefully be passionate about what you're writing about, because I think that interior motivation is what's going to keep you going, because you might not always get comments and you might not always get someone saying, hey, great job. But if you love what you're doing already, that won't matter. And I think that's the most important thing. You know, don't get too wrapped up on all the other stuff. Do it because you love it. And I think everything else will follow. And I know that sounds like a cliche, but I really think it's true. I mean, I think for me, I mean, I love Texas food. And for me, it's just, I mean, I'll spend hours a week just researching, or, you know, talking to friends and family about, you know, memories and recipes, or, you know, reading old newspapers. And for me, that's like the best way to spend my time. You know, it's not work. It's very fun for me. And so that's what keeps me going. And I think anybody to have a long-term relationship with the blog, you know, I wouldn't say it's a marriage, but you got to love what you're doing.
some kind of,
sometimes you get bored with it, but I think, you know, if you want to, you know, parlay it into anything, you know, you should post on a regular basis. You know, people post every day, and I personally think that's ridiculous. I mean, if you want to do that, that's fine, but there's just so much content out there now that it's really the rare person that's going to keep up with something every day. I'm a bad blogger. I've been blogging almost every week, but I usually do every two weeks because I've been busy with the books and stuff like that. But, you know, just be regular. I mean, don't plog like twice a year.
Right. Some sort of pattern.
Yeah.
And so, like you're saying, just in your own life and especially with this book, The Family Table, you were culling a lot of recipes from your family and friends, right? And so
yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like? I imagine there was a big sort of emotional component or some some moments where you're like, wow. I mean, what was it like going through those recipes?
Well, yeah, it was for me, it was emotional, but I mean, it was always like really happy emotions. It was like really, I knew both of my great grandmothers. I did have that privilege. So I remember them, but I didn't know them that well. And, you know, my grandma, she gave me these like stacks of handwritten recipe cards from them. And so when I was going through their recipes, you know, it was like they were in the kitchen with me, and it was just, you know, feeling connected to this past that I sort of remembered, but, you know, I don't really remember cooking with them or anything like that. So for me, it was just this like great way to connect with my, you know, who I was and where I was from. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's kind of how it was. And then also, I do have recipes in there from dear friends and things that they grew up with. You know, they might have, like, I have my friend's gumbo recipe. You know, he's from Southeast Texas. And my family didn't really do gumbo, but in Southeast Texas, which is on the Louisiana border, they totally do gumbo. But it's a Texas-style gumbo. It's not like a gumbo you're going to find in Opelousas, Louisiana. And that was fun for me, too. You know, just, you know, other families and what they consider, you know, their sort of iconic Texan dishes. That was fun.
So what is a Texan gumbo? Because I've been to Louisiana, and I know that the debate about gumbo there is fierce as well. So what do Texans say?
Oh, well, what made his a Texas gumbo is he didn't use the Trinity, which was unusual, but he also had smoked Texas sausage in it. That was like the key that made it more Texan. But then, you know, I know, like, I do have Cajun friends, and they're like, you can never put tomatoes in gumbo. And I know a lot of Texans that put tomatoes in gumbo. So there's also gumbo, chili, and barbecue are three things. If you ever want to get in an argument or have a long discussion, just bring those topics up.
Right. Yes. Yes. I have learned that the hard way. So speaking of, I mean, everybody has their hometown spots that they go, and you do get back to Texas a decent amount. Where do you eat when you're there, and what do you miss when you're not? You're just like, oh, I need.
Well, when I go home to Houston, usually my first stop off the plane is I go into town, kind of outside of downtown, Ninfa's on Navigation, which is the original Ninfa's. Ninfa's became a chain, and it's a long story, and I don't want to go into it. But basically, when it became a chain, the quality was diluted, and then the family sold. So this restaurant actually has no connection with the original family, but it is the original recipes, and the quality is as it always was. And it is my favorite, and it's just this iconic Houston Tex-Mex. It's very beef-based. You know, they say that Ninfa, you know, was the one that popularized fajitas in Houston. And then she also has this green salsa that's like tomatillos and avocados and really creamy. And I don't know if she was the first one to serve it, but in Houston, but she was the one that made it really popular in Houston. And so these two things, you know, fajitas, beef fajitas, or tacos al carbon, and this green salsa is total Houston classic Tex-Mex, you know.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
It is so good.
I want some.
Yeah.
And you're also a certified barbecue judge.
Yeah.
Right? I've always wondered, because you hear that all the time, like, so-and-so, author, TV personality, chef, barbecue judge. How does that happen?
You take a class.
You?
No, you actually take a class. And it's the Kansas City Barbecue Society, and they train you. And there's two main schools of barbecue competition. There's the Memphis, and then there's the Kansas City style. And I'm not an expert, so I'm not going to talk too much about that. But basically, for the Kansas City style, before you can be a judge at a Kansas City certified competition, you have to like take this all-day class, and you basically just sit around and eat meat all day.
Sounds really hard.
It is. Yeah, it's a challenge.
Yeah, I'm joking, but I'm also serious, because I've had to like taste test things before, and you really got to have like restraint. And
you got to have stamina.
Tactic. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, like an amateur, you know, I'm like, ooh, a whole thing of ribs, you know, and then by the end, you're like, just one bite.
One bite at a time.
Yeah.
So when was the last, do you judge regularly?
Or? No, I haven't judged in forever. there aren't as many opportunities in New York City. Most of the competitions are out on Long Island or up in the Northeast. And I don't have a car, and it's always... I'd like to judge again, though. It's fun. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Do you have any, like, crazy stories from when you did judge or memorable?
Oh, no. Like- I didn't actually judge that many, so no. Okay. Yeah, I've actually done a lot more chili competitions than barbecue.
Interesting. So, chili competitions. Uh-huh.
The, every May, usually, the Texas Longhorns, the Texas X's, the Longhorn, the University of Texas Longhorn Alumni Association, they do a big chili cook-off. And I've been a judge for that for many years.
Well, and you say in the book that if chili has beans in it, then it's not chili anymore. I mean,
that's a Texan thing. I didn't come up with that. But I mean, that's how I was raised. And there's actually like chili, true chili competitions down in Texas where there's actual rules and you can't have beans.
that's in the rule book.
It is in the rule book. Yeah, there's a lot of rules, but that's like the main one. And so you just grow up knowing that Texas chili doesn't have beans or it shouldn't have beans. But I mean, there's a lot of reasons why. The most popular might be just the pure fact that that beans are great on their own and chili's great on their own. And, you know, it almost disrespects both of them if you combine the two. I don't know if that's true or not.
Interesting. Have you ever had a bean chili that you've enjoyed or you don't call it, you can't even call it chili?
Yeah, no, I usually call it bean soup, but I'm going to admit something. When I was probably like 11 years old, I got really rebellious, and there was a woman who had moved from a family had moved from like Michigan to Houston at our church, and she brought in chili with beans. And for like a year, I made my mom put beans in my chili as my rebellion. Wow. My family was horrified, but she used ranch style beans, which is a canned bean in Texas. So, I mean, it was still, you know, authentic. Yeah. But she was just like, I guess if you're going to rebel, this is a fine way to rebel versus doing other things, but still.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of parents wish that their teenagers would do that. Like, I want beans in my chili, even though it's not the way we do it here. Well, we're just about out of time, Lisa, but one last question. I'm sure you're getting it a lot, but what are some of your favorite recipes in the book or that you cook or, I mean, sort of recipes like the beanless chili that people would say, like, hey, I never knew that about Texan food?
Yeah.
What stands out for you in the book?
Well, there's a recipe in there for very classic chicken and dumplings, which I kind of jazz it up a little bit with some cilantro and chipotle chilies, but it's basically like kind of how your great grandma made it, but I've just made it a little bit fresher. And, you know, that's more old fashioned kind of Texan cooking and mm-hmm. Southern cooking in general, but I love that recipe. The chicken spaghetti, which is chicken and spaghetti and chili peppers and tomatoes and lots of cheese. That's, again, it's very old fashioned, but very delicious. And I've updated it too. I got rid of the Velveeta and the cream soups. pecan pie, it's a state dish of Texas, and my grandma's recipes in the book. So there's, I mean, you know, it's funny, like people will say, what's your favorite recipe? And I love them all. I mean, they're all, it's a good, I'm biased, but they're near good. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we're out of time, but thank you so much for being with us. This has been another great episode of Eat Your Words. Lisa Fain's new book, Homesick Texan Family Table, is out now, so definitely check it out. She also has a blog. And thank you guys so much for listening. This is Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.